record them, all of our classes. So if you miss, you can always listen to it online. I don't know if people really do that. But Ron, who is not joining us this year because Ron moved, yeah, he's so great. But he said, if you post it online and keep me on the email list, I'll listen. So we're doing this for Ron. If not, hi, Ron. Okay, go ahead.
I'm Susan Paskin. I guess I decided to take this class because I feel like I don't know enough about Israel, and I wanted to understand the history and present day, what's going on.
I'm Daryl Cohan. I decided to take this class because I haven't taken a class in a long time. And I think I'm continually surprised by the idea that there was nothing and this whole country was created in a very short period of time.
Joel Golden, same reason. I have fairly superficial knowledge of Israel, and I would get into discussions about the Middle East and Israel, Palestine, and so forth. So I wanted to understand more background.
Randy Sasko. I ditto anybody's previous comments. And what was interesting is in the last, like, how often I would refer to information I learned in class, like how it comes up in conversation. I was surprised, but I thought it was very cool.
Nice.
Ilana Beckman. My kids have been to Israel numerous times. My daughter spent a year there last year. We were there multiple times. I first of all, this class has given me so much more appreciation for the creation of Israel. I had no idea about all the thought that went into creating this. I thought it was sort of simple Zionism. But anyway, it's been fabulous and eye-opening.
Judy Belgrade, I guess I took class for the same reasons. Because I used to get into conversations with people, and I felt like I was talking out of a vacuum. And now I feel like I'm a real bore, because I tell people stuff and they go, really? You know, because, you know, all the stuff with the mandate and all this. And Zionism, so many different facets of Zionism. Who knows this? Nobody knows about all this. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I read a book that I really enjoyed called Catch of the Jew.
Oh, yeah.
By Tuvia Tannenbaum.
Yeah.
And I recommend it. The Needham Library has it. Or they both have it on their website. And it's a really fun book. He's a journalist.
He's very interesting.
He's very cynical.
Yeah.
Goes.
Catch the Jew.
Catch the Jew.
Visits Palestinians in the guise of, he is a journalist, but he goes in the guise of a German.
Yep.
And, you know, depending on who he's talking to, he says he's Jewish or he's German or he's an Arab.
How'd you come across the book? Because not many people know it.
Well, I always took that little section in the library, and it was just there.
The section that says not many people know these books.
Yeah.
Please read us.
It's the book of your friends.
Nonfiction.
Yep.
I checked the Middle East book.
Yeah.
It was there.
Yep.
And there it was. And the cover was kind of funny, and I looked at it, and I thought, well, this might be like a light reading. It's sort of light reading, but it's distressing to me.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's a great book to read. Catch the Jew. Tuvia Tannenbaum. I mean, it's based upon his real experiences, but he, you know, fictionalizes a bit who he is, right, in order to get from point A to point B and to interact with these individuals. But it's definitely a worthwhile read.
I have studied Israeli history in college, so I would say this is far more valuable than what I studied. And it's been a lot of years since then. I want to be able to give my opinions and actually have them make sense, which I'm not sure they do yet, but I'm hoping they'll do. I've been reading Ari Shahid's book, and which I'm struggling with because it's beautifully written.
Yeah.
And I'm bothered by what I agree with, and I'm bothered by a certain way he presents things, and it's been very thought-provoking.
Good.
Jeff Overby, I feel like when I went with my wife to meet her whole mishpacha, and there's a room full of 23ers, and I don't know who I've been talking about. But I get this book by Benny Shapiro, probably 5 years ago, Righteous Victims, and I just can't read it. I can't get past page 20, so I thought something like this would... And then comes the summer, and this bloodshed in Israel, it's important to know about what's going on.
Yeah. Good. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure. You'll be part of the Mishpacha very soon.
Oh, okay. We're friendly crowd.
That's right. That's right.
I'm Linda Mesnick. I took this class because I did go on the temple trip with my family. Now it's been almost 5 years. But my kids have gone, my older daughter, and then my son went, not this summer, but the year before when all that conflict happened. And I felt like then this class was offered, and I said, oh, I should take this. Because I really couldn't explain to my younger daughter, still at home even, what was going on. You know, I needed more knowledge. And she's still going to go in 2 years to Israel. So it was perfect timing for me. And especially this year is the stuff I want to learn, like the current stuff that's in the news that, you know, when I follow it, it'll make sense.
Yep, that's right. So last year, just so you know, Jeff, and I can share the syllabus with you, last year was basically the precursors to Zionism and looking at the intellectual ideas and historical context in which Zionism emerged. But we got right up to the point in which, right before the state was created, right? And this year it's the creation of the state to the present.
1845.
Right.
That's about all I know.
Good.
I'm Ann Barron, and I took this class. I was so excited when I saw it. Because my husband and I went to Israel almost 2 years ago, and I planned the trip, and I did a ton of reading, and so I learned some history, but when I saw this, and when I went there, I was like, this is amazing. And when I saw this class, I said, I need to know way more. I just couldn't get enough of it. So this is so perfect, and it's just been incredible. And as far as the summer goes, I find that I can read the paper every single day and just find something relevant to what we've learned, sometimes very importantly. And I also read two books this summer, one called Safekeeping, which is fiction, takes place on a kibbutz, and one called My Father's Paradise, which is nonfiction, and both of them, completely different angles of what we've learned, but they were fantastic.
Good.
Emailed you.
That's all right. Yeah.
What was the first one called?
Safekeeping. It just came out actually in the spring, I think.
And My Father's Paradise is also new, isn't it?
Actually, I think it's like more a couple, maybe.
Okay.
Yes, I mean, it is fairly new, and that is just an unbelievable story.
Yeah. I'm Roger Patkin, and I'm taking this class for a few reasons. I'm fascinated with Israel. I've been there several times. Want to learn more about it. It's also a way for me to learn more about who I am. Both of our girls are at Jewish day school, and so it's a way to connect with them around something that's very important to all of us, and it's also fun to do with my wife.
It's like a date.
That's right. There you go. Well, thank you all. I'm Rachel, as you know. I work at Brandeis University, and I'm the Associate Director of the Schusterman Center for Israel Studies, where we train the next generation of doctoral candidates in the field of Israel Studies, and we have programming for the university community, and I teach at the university, and I usually teach graduate students, but undergrads as well often creep in there. So in the spring, I actually taught at Harvard the Arab-Israeli conflict, which was very interesting, and to a very different audience than the graduate students that I teach at Brandeis. At Brandeis, when I teach the graduate students, I'm teaching specifically the graduate students who are doing a dual degree in Jewish professional leadership, and it's a master's degree in either an MBA or public policy. So these are the future leaders of Jewish communal organizations, everything from JCCs to summer camps to federation, that kind of person. And they always go to Israel twice during their 2-year program. So so I developed the itinerary for that, and I accompany them on their study tour. But I actually teach their course because in the past they didn't really have solid Israel education. Much of it was more about how do Jewish communal or agencies interact with Israel, which is a component, an important component, but they actually need to understand a lot more about Israel itself as a social, political entity in the context of the Middle East. So I sort of balance both of those components for them. And then every other year I teach an undergraduate course. And that just depends. It could just be a general Israel study, Israel, you know, Israeli history class, or it could be Zionist thought and ideology. So it just depends on the year. So that's what I do. And this year for Tzion, and I had the privilege of teaching this last year, I loved it. Like, I walked away feeling like this was fantastic. So I hope you guys felt the same. I think so. Yeah.
We're all
back. That's right. That's right. That's right. See, we miss you, Ron. and I saw David last night, actually, and this is interesting for you all to know. So part of one of the projects I'm working on, and this relates to our conversation that we're having tonight, is that what I'm finding more and more is that there are people coming to us from different walks of life, mostly from practitioners who are either teaching in Jewish day schools or these professionals who are in Jewish communal capacities, who say, we really don't know enough about Israel, from the Hillel professional to the day school educator. And what we do is we're really at a different level because we're expecting everyone to read every single footnote when they're in the Israel Studies program at Brandeis. And what we're realizing is there needs to be some sort of middle ground, much more like Tzion, for these other audiences beyond the academy. So we recognized this about 3 years ago. And so part of what we have been doing is thinking about how do you educate about Israel and make people literate about Israel in the 21st century. And so this is a project that we've undertaken and we've begun. And so last night I had orchestrated a meeting in collaboration with Facing History, the organization, right, who teaches in public schools and in Jewish day schools about the Holocaust. Because they have a specific component within Facing History for Jewish day schools and how you teach about the Holocaust and also other genocides. And now they expand to even things related to bullying and those other components. It's part of that. That's right. So we brought together a handful of day school educators from just the Boston area to have a very informal conversation and create a safe space in which they could share their thoughts. And what's very fascinating is that one is the schools aren't clear where they stand on Israel, right? So Israel could be a major component of the school's mission, but that could mean a lot of different things, right? That could mean just Ahavat Yisrael, love of Israel, but it could also mean that they want to teach advocacy less so than education about Israel. They could say that it's about identity and how it relates to their Jewish identity. They could say it's about, we want to teach critical thinking and Israel is where we want to do that, right? So that's an interesting piece because not all of these schools really know how they want Israel to be integrated into the curriculum, and some of them still silo the study of Israel or whatever they want to do with Israel within the curriculum. So it's not something that permeates and all the facets that it could or should. The other piece is that as much as we're interested in helping the faculty be able to transmit knowledge to their students and for their students to be able to walk away with serious, sophisticated knowledge before they go on college campuses, because what's very much happening is that they go on these college campuses and have a very rude awakening, and then they don't know how to deal with some of the Israel confrontation that they might face on campuses. And if you haven't seen, there's a documentary made by a group of day school alumni from all over the country called Between the Lines. You should see it if you haven't. It's on YouTube, so if you just go on YouTube, Between the Lines. But it's a worthwhile thing. I think this is a self-select group of students. I think you should know these are students who are the creme de la creme. These are students who come from very educated Jewish families. Many of them are children of professors, often in Jewish studies. So these are not These are kids who are deeply engaged in Jewish life and Jewish thought, and they're sitting around Shabbat tables. That's what is the conversation. So these are not people that you would consider anti-Zionist or anti-Israel, but you need to hear what these students are saying, because it's symptomatic of a problem in terms of Jewish education and how the study of Israel is taught in these day schools. And so when I was listening to the teachers last night, very much all of them, the focus of what they were saying was, we need to work with students, but first we have to help the faculty. Because the faculty themselves are conflicted about how to talk about Israel, are all over the map in terms of their own identity issues related to Israel, let alone any of the politicization that comes around it, and all of them have serious concerns about parental pressure that they will face when speaking about Israel. So I know that, but this is really what's on their minds, and it's all the more imperative in my mind of why the Schusterman Center, even though we train faculty or the next generation of faculty, also need to be thinking about how to train at an even younger age working, because Israel, right, as Linda has said many times, is such an important component, not only for Jews, but also for one's own ability to speak about and to find ways to engage with. So that's something that's happening. In terms of this course, there are two primary texts that you should purchase, if you can, on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. I see many of you have them. The first is this book, Israel, a History, by Anita Shapira, and I recommend you get it. It's also, you can download it, you know, it's an ebook form as well. Anita is one of the premier historians of Israeli history in Israel. She's professor emeritus from Tel Aviv University, and she was asked by our center, by Ilan Tron, who was the director at the time, to write this book, and that's why it was written. Now, why it was written as well is because before this book, there really hasn't been a comprehensive history that's readable. Howard Safer, if that name sounds familiar in terms of a historian, wrote a history of Israel as well, and you're talking about a book that was thousands of pages in very tiny print that most people couldn't get through. The amount of detail is incredible, but it's a very challenging read. And so Anita's book, which I think you will find as we go through it, and we will be using it a lot, has quite a bit of information, but it's very readable. She also, what's nice about it, we really try to have her steer away from too many footnotes so you don't get lost in some of that. But at the end of the chapters, what you'll find is she writes out the bibliography both in English and Hebrew and then suggestions for further reading. So if there's something that you're really taken by, that's there for you. Plus, I'm happy to, you know, suggest things if you don't find something that you're looking for. But this is an important book that you should have on your bookshelf, I would argue. So that's one. The second is this book, which is The Origins of Israel. This is a primary source reader. We had it last year as well. If you can get it, it's worth having. Derek Penslar, who is going to actually be a professor soon at Harvard University, and will be in our neck of the woods, has really amassed and collected many of these primary sources, and gives a little bit of, you know, commentary before the source and then gives you the text itself. The other primary source reader that we will use, that you don't necessarily need to purchase, either it will be up on Dropbox in terms of the selections or I'll get them to you in advance, is Yehuda Reinhardt's and Itamar Rabinovich's book called Israel and the Middle East. It's a reader as well, primary source. Much of that focuses on military kind of history and foreign policy type history, whereas this is much more social, cultural text. But both are important, so that's, and no one book actually does everything. So that's why we will have those selections. Now, I hope that all of you are able to access Dropbox. If you're not, tell me after class and we'll try to figure out why. But on Dropbox, same as last year, you're going to find both the syllabus for the class, right? And we're going to try to stick to it as much as possible. The reason we started so late in terms of meeting this year was because of the Chagim. And then last week I actually was presenting in Oxford, right? That's kind of cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'd never been, so that was nice. But we are going to skip a couple of weeks sometimes, you'll see. So just pay attention because I have a couple of work commitments that I have to go to. But for the most part, we pretty much go straight through. And I took into consideration holidays, but if for some reason we need to rearrange a date, let us know and we'll figure it out. And then also, of course, as winter comes, hopefully we won't have
the Monday storm.
Exactly. Hopefully we won't have too many, but we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. So this is the syllabus. If at some point someone is interested and bringing snacks, if we want to do that again, we can figure that out so we can, you know, write down and take turns and rotate who brings snacks. We can decide that. And then the other link on Dropbox is the link that will have any materials that aren't in one of the purchased books, right? So if you have a problem. And also remember, you don't have to read everything. A lot of that stuff David or I just put in there because it's something we think is important and we want to put it in the right folder at the time, but it doesn't mean we're actually going to use it. If it's something that we feel is very important, we'll bring it to your attention during class or in an email. We'll try to call your attention to that as well so that you can know to read a certain piece. So that's how the materials are set up. So if you have questions...
Does the syllabus sort of pick out some of the ones you'd want us to read?
Well, the syllabus is, ideally, you read what's on the syllabus, but in the Dropbox folders, there's more than what's
right,
on the syllabus.
As long as we read
if it's on the syllabus, it's ideal for you to read. If you can't get to everything, that's fine. But the addition, there are extra supplemental materials in each folder sometimes that relate to the topic, but it's not required reading necessarily. Okay? All right, so what I figured we would do today is basically a recap of our entire last year. In case you missed last year, you're going to get it right now, and then you'll be fine. And also because it has been several months, and so before we just pick up right where we left off, it's worthwhile for us, I think, to just step back and remember where we were and jog our own memories. And then after we do that, we can take a little break, and I'm very mindful of the time. So that we'll try to make sure we're done by 9.
Excuse me, I'm leaving. So this is going to stay unlocked. You know what to do, right?
Yep.
Everything. And then if there, anybody that's going downstairs, the door may be locked when you go out, so just press the, you know, the silver button down there. If anybody parks in the basement, if not, the silver one by the front door to get out, because everything locks up on its own at 8.
Okay. When we come each week, we just park right outside.
You can. You can.
Okay.
Because by the time you get here, most people are already gone. Okay?
Thank
Sorry
you.
To interrupt. Thank
you. Thank
Have
you.
A good night.
Thank you. Okay. And then the last thing that I wanted to do is there's a film that came out in this past Jewish Film Festival, and it hasn't been widely released, and it's going to be widely released this upcoming Jewish Film Festival, and I wanted to show just a little clip from that film. The title at the time of the film, if any of you saw it, was called The Zionist Idea, but so maybe a few of you saw it. It's been edited a bit for purposes of... Correct, that's Arthur Hertzberg's... Good, Joel, good. But it's edited for a few reasons, it will be a bit different than what you had seen previously, but I'm going to show just a 10-minute clip of it that I think, again, it's just a worthwhile dialogue to have in your mind as you move through this course. Okay, so let's begin with some of the whirlwind ideas and tour of last year and on 1 foot, 45 minutes, right? 50 minutes. So, first of all, let's think about Where did we start this story last year? Does anyone remember? We started in biblical times. And why did we start in biblical times last year? What was the purpose of starting? Because Zionism as a concept is not a biblical concept, right?
It's understanding what makes a country or what makes a civilization.
Okay, so understanding what brings together a people.
And why this area was so important.
Okay, why this specific real estate matters, right? Why do we care about this particular place? And we can see why we care about this place because of some of the ideas that begin in the Torah, right? So what's an example of that? Anyone have an example?
Well, God said to Abraham, pick up your stuff and leave your family behind. Go to this land that I'm going to show you all about. You've got to trust me. And Lot went with him.
That's right.
It was a covenant.
That's right. So it's part of a covenant, a covenantal relationship, a breach between Abraham, the descendants of Abraham, and God. And what happens and transpires throughout this land has religious significance, right? Religious cult type significance and symbols that then emerge as well. And this is everything from certain observance practices that you can only do in this particular territory, like the laws of Shemitah, right? Like taking a sabbatical and what you have to do on the land, on the seventh year of the land, and how you can't observe that anywhere else but in this specific territory. To other revolts or battles that take place between other peoples and what that means for the Israelite community. We talked about what it means to become this community, this B'nai Yisrael, right? The people of Israel. And then this is also where we started talking about what those shared identities are. But this is where we started our story. And we did a little bit in the medieval period. And then we got up to the 19th century, where the idea of Zionism, as we understand it as a movement for national self-determination, really begins, right? So let's talk about the 19th century, because that's really where this idea of Zionism emerges. So what's happening in the 1880s? Where are Jews? Are they living? The majority of Jews are living where? They're living in Europe. Eastern Europe. How many Jews approximately are living in Palestine in 1882, for example? How much? Not 100,000. 20,000. Right? So approximately 20,000 Jews are living in Palestine. And who are these people? Who are these Jews? Are they... They're mostly halachically observant. They're Orthodox. Right? Where did they come from? So some from Eastern Europe.
Some from the surrounding countries.
Some from the surrounding countries. And remember, there has always been a Jewish presence in this land of Palestine, but not necessarily for the purposes of nationalism, right? So the people, the Jews that were living in Palestine before really this movement of Zionism, that's called the Old Yishuv. Right? This is where Jews live, and Yishuv is Y-I-S-H-U-V. This is where Jews live because there's a connection to this land because of religious reasons, but it wasn't because of nationalism, per se. Now,
were they largely supported by their old community?
So we're going to get to that because the Jews who come first in that first wave of Aliyah, in that first wave of immigration, are, right? Those are still, those Jews are coming from Eastern Europe and Russia. They're coming for a combination of nationalistic reasons, but also because of religious reasons, and they're very poor. And they're being supported by, remember, people like Baron Rothschild, right? The Rothschild. They're being supported by outside philanthropists. They don't really have the means to support themselves. Now, the Jews who were living in Palestine as part of the Old Yishuv, it's a very poor community. This is a religiously, you know, observing community. These are communities where they're studying in yeshivot all the time. But it's a very small percentage of the population and a very poor population. Now, by 1948, approximately how many Jews live in this land? 600,000. About 600,000 Jews. So what we did last year was look at the motivations for why people were coming, what brought people. We talked a lot about push and pull factors. Remember this? What's a push factor?
Persecution,
pogroms, anti-Semitism. You're feeling very much like you need to get out of wherever you were from that host society. And remember, recall people like that we read, like Leon Pinsker, right, who's a physician, auto-emancipation, exactly, where they're talking about the Jews not being whole individuals, that they are alien in some sense, that they're a phantom of themselves. Remember, he uses a lot of medical terminology because that's who he is professionally. What's a pull factor?
Nationalism.
So perhaps it's nationalism. What else?
That was different for different people. There was the religious, there was the social.
That's right. So the pull factors depend upon which vision of Zionism you're most interested in, right? So that's a good place to start. One potential pull factor is the pull factor for labor Zionists. Now, labor Zionists, if you recall, were one of the larger branches of Zionism. And they're the political party that ultimately is going to win the day in terms of political Zionism when the state first emerges. Plus, they're the political party that is in power from 1948 until 1977. So they have a very important role in terms of the ideology surrounding the emergence of the state, the way they imagine the state ought to be formed, and how they think there ought to be interactions between Jews, Arabs, and what this place is going to be about. So what are some of the ideas around labor Zionism? This is Ben-Gurion. Labor Zionism is Ben-Gurion. They want to work the land. It's A.D. Gordon, if you remember some of the readings of A.D. Gordon.
They want to work with people. They want to alienate everybody else.
Yep. What else?
They want to rid of, I think they wanted to get rid of like that, you know, weak, the idea of the weak Jews.
That's right. So this is where you start to hear of certain narratives and myths within Zionism. The Sabra identity. What was the Sabra identity? The identity of moving that old Jew, right, the one who's bent over and studying in a yeshiva, the one who is beholden to other people, right? The new Jew is this blonde-haired, blue-eyed, right?
Strong,
working, very muscular, virile, working the land.
The shovel in one hand.
That's right.
And the other.
That's right. Exactly. That's right. These are the new Jews, right? These are the new Jews. And one of their main ideologies?
Socialism.
That's right. So it's about collectivism, socialism, and they're very much, they're anti-religious, right? They're secular individuals, they're trade unionists at the end of the day. So these are the types of people who are associated with labor Zionism. They're mostly young, mostly men. The women who are involved in labor Zionism, if you recall, expected, remember, I think we read in here a piece by Moshe Dayan's
mother,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we saw, you know, this was a woman who was educated in Europe. But
and when
she
got here, when she got to Israel, she was still expected to do the cooking in the
laundry. That's right, when she got to Palestine, right, because it's before the
right.
state. She thought she was going to have a very different role in terms of because of her gender, and she was going to be able to take a more not masculine, but a much more...
non-domestic?
Yeah, non-domestic. That's right, and equal. It was about supposed to be egalitarianism. And it turns out she's, you know, cooking and doing the laundry. And she, you know, what is this? This is not what I signed up for, kind of thing. We read some of those excerpts from that book, The Plow Woman, right? So this is also part of the conversation. The kibbutznik, even though we know this was a very small percentage of the population and that kibbutzim really weren't taking over all of this land of Palestine, the idea of the kibbutz was a major idea because of that collective socialist idea. The idea of avodah ivri, right, the Hebrew workers, Hebrew labor working the land. These were the ideas of socialism. And it's really not until 1977 when Begin comes into power that some of that begins to deteriorate. In some ways, because Begin, as we're going to learn more about this year, is coming from the Likud party, which is the prodigy, whatever, of Jabotinsky revisionist Zionism, right? It's going to be from that line of Zionism. What about then another form of Zionism, like you said, Alana? What's another form? So we have labor Zionism. What was another vision?
Well, I mean, Herzl's initial one was basically just to transplant location, to take Europe and move it over.
That's right. So Herzl as the political Zionist. So Herzl is the political Zionist. And what do we recall about Herzl? Was Herzl a literate Jew?
No.
Remember, he was completely secular.
Yeah.
He actually knew nothing about Judaism. He wasn't interested in learning about Judaism. He was not a rabbi. He had no Jewish training, no Jewish education. And what made him recognize that there was this need for a Jewish state with a capital S? That's right. So it's anti-Semitism, and the real impetus here is the Dreyfus Affair. And it's because of what happens with Dreyfus that Herzl, because Herzl's this journalist, he's completely assimilated, completely acculturated, and it's that affair, you know, when the high-ranking official from the French army is accused of treason because he's a Jew, all of these pieces, that Herzl says, wait a minute, if this can happen in France, this could probably happen everywhere. And so this is really the reason Herzl starts to really think about. Now, Herzl, what we recall is that Herzl was a skilled diplomat at the end of the day. That's who Herzl was. He's taking meetings with the Kaiser. He's trying to meet with the Sultan and the Ottoman Empire. He's a diplomat. And he's trying to figure out how to bring together the cacophony of noise that he's hearing within Zionism to focus them in a laser way on creating an actual political nation state. That's what he wants. And for him, he believes that's the only answer. Now, what that nation state looks like is exactly what you said, Alana. It's transporting whatever Europe looks like, the opera houses, the multicultural, multilinguistic interactions into this place in the Mediterranean, right? He doesn't want to deal with the religious Jews. He's not so interested in thinking about Arab-Jewish relations. He really just imagines that you bring these Jews from Europe over to this place in the Mediterranean, and they'll figure it out.
And they're protected.
And they'll have some sort of, that's right, protection. He doesn't talk about the revitalization of Hebrew language, right? He doesn't care. That's just not his thing. And then, remember, he puts forth this idea of what other alternative, if you can't get people to
Uganda.
Right? Right. But it ultimately doesn't work, right? Because, as we know, Uganda's not going to draw people to this cause. Okay. What's another form of Zionism that we discussed?
Religious.
So what was religious Zionism? It's a minority position, right? Some of the precursors to religious Zionists were people like Rav Reines, Rav Cook. These Reines is R-E-I-N-E-S. Yehuda Cook is the son of Abraham Cook. Abraham Cook is the one who's named the chief rabbi of Palestine. He sets up the Merkaz HaRav Cook, which becomes the most important religious yeshiva in Palestine. Later, his son Yehuda Cook is the one who forms Gush Emunim. We're going to talk about that this year. Gush Emunim is part of the settler movement. Emunim is E-M-U-N-I-M. Right, so religious Zionism is about doing mitzvot, doing the following the laws and doing the deeds that are required from the Torah that you have to be doing in the land of Israel, right? And there's an endowment of religious significance to being in the land of Israel, right? So what was fascinating about Rav Cook was that part of what he wanted to do was to endow the secular labor socialist Zionists with religious significance and make them appropriate them in some ways, because he says, well, look, they're actually building the land and that's religiously important, so it's okay that they're doing it, right? But those labor socialist Zionists wanted nothing to do with the religious Zionists, right?
The religious Zionists, they were thinking that God would be the divine.
That's right.
Would bring back.
That's right. So there's still a piece of that. This is the tricky part for a religious Zionist.
Right.
If you're a religious Zionist, there's a real tension, and Anne's hitting the nail on the head here, right? There's a real tension because as a religiously observant Jew, you can't really interfere with messianic plans. That's a problem, right? But at the same time, as a Zionist, you're going to be the one who's the agent in taking control and have agency and not be reliant upon a divine being. So that's a tension that really does exist. So the way Rav Cook, and I'm simplifying dramatically, and the person you need to read is Yehuda Mirsky, M-I-R-S-K-Y. He wrote a biography on Rav Cook. It's actually very readable. It's great length. And it's quite good. It's part of that Yale series where they have, if you haven't looked at this, it's worth knowing. Yale publishers have this wonderful series of biographies of individuals, Jewish individuals. That's quite good. And so it's part of that series. So to simplify what Yehuda Mirsky wrote about in much detail, is that Rav Cook basically has to figure out how he can encourage people who are religiously observant to engage with Zionism without feeling as if they're interfering with this messianic divine plan that exists. And this is part of what Rav Cook has to do. So that's religious Zionism. What's another form of Zionism?
Cultural.
Okay, cultural. So who are the cultural spiritual Zionists? Who's one of the founders? Achad Ha'am, right? Whose real name is Asher Ginsberg. But he gives himself the pen name Achad Ha'am, a bit presumptuous, right? Because Achad means one, Ha'am is the nation, but it also could be the people, so it's like one of the people, but it's one nation, so this is Achad Ha'am. Achad Ha'am, and also I think I told you this before, you have to say Achad Ha'am, it's like Big Bird. You can't just say Bird, right? You have to say Achad Ha'am. So that's always fun. Achad Ha'am looks at Zionism and says, Zionism cannot be like all these other nationalistic movements that are taking and sweeping Europe in the 19th century. We have to be different, we meaning the Jews. And our models for ethical, moral behavior come from whom? The prophets. They come from the prophets. And so we need to make sure that we behave in a fashion that that is modeled, they're the archetype that is modeled after the prophets. Now he's also influenced, or others are influenced by him, like Martin Buber. And Martin Buber becomes, and there are many others, especially coming from a German intellectual elite who are attracted to cultural spiritual Zionism. So people like Gershom Shalom, Hans Kohn, these are the individuals, Judah Magnus, who often become the faculty members and leadership of Hebrew University, which is established in 1925, before the state is created. And cultural spiritual Zionists are ultimately putting forth a political vision that entails what? What kind of state do they imagine?
Non-religious state.
But don't they all want to speak Hebrew?
Something that's united by language, the arts.
That's right. So it's Hebrew language is extremely important. And remember, it's about the renaissance of Hebrew culture and Hebrew identity. And it's this diagram I drew for you once that is a circle, which is supposed to be Palestine. And you have all this renaissance, rejuvenation, right, return, that prefix re, right? All this activity about Hebrew identity and Jewish identity and culture and spirituality, which doesn't necessarily mean religious observance, but connection to the spiritual aspect. And all of that is supposed to radiate out towards diaspora. And remember, it's not symmetrical. What happens in diaspora doesn't radiate in. It was only radiating out. And in terms of a political state, what they imagined was a binational state. One state for two peoples, meaning Jews and Arabs, living in this land of Palestine in cooperation and coexistence, where it's quite utopian, where you would have exchange of languages, where there would be trade unions for Jews and Arabs together. Many of the cultural spiritual Zionists were willing to not have equal parity in terms of immigration numbers, so you would still have a larger Arab population and a smaller Jewish population. Some of the adherents of cultural spiritual Zionism took that to an extreme, right? So there were people like Judah Magnus, even when we knew what was happening during the Holocaust, who still argued that you shouldn't let, you know, that many Jews in because he was afraid of what it would mean in terms of the relationship between Jews and Arabs. And for many of the cultural spiritual Zionists, the turning point for them in terms of Zionism, in which they really became dissatisfied with the leadership of political Zionism, those who are associated with more labor socialist ideas, was 1929. What happens in 1929? You have riots. You have Arab riots between Arabs living in Palestine and the Jews who are living in Palestine. And then again, you see these tensions flare up from 1936 to 1939. And in that period of time, it's very clear that this is an orchestrated revolt between Arabs and Jews. 1929, it's not so clear how orchestrated it was. It was much more of individuals and tensions between individuals and pockets in a community, whereas 36 to 39, it's very clear. It's much more focused on Arabs living in Palestine responding to Jews coming into Palestine and the desire to push them out. And this is actually one of the pressing academic questions in terms of scholarship, which is, is Palestinian nationalism only in response to Zionism, or did Palestinian nationalism emerge for other purposes? And that's really one of the leading scholarly questions that people are afraid to touch because of the politicization that it now takes on. So that's something that's looked at. So that's the cultural spiritual Zionists. And then there's one other form of, I mean, there's not only one, but really one other main form of Zionism.
Revisionist
Zionism.
So where are the labor Zionists? They're sort of...
So labor Zionists are political Zionists.
Okay.
So revisionist Zionists and labor Zionists are both political Zionists. Right? They're the heirs of Herzl and to some degree, but they diverge from one another. Because what happens is labor Zionism is much more about socialism, collectivism, and also more willing to recognize the potential for cooperation between Arabs and Jews, revisionist Zionism, which is with Jabotinsky, if you recall. Jabotinsky, it's, first of all, trying to overthrow the British and get the British out of Palestine, and that's actually the number one enemy at the time. And then it's trying to deal with the Arabs, and this is where you get the idea of the Iron Wall, where you should erect an iron wall between the Arabs and Jews who are living in this territory. And then part of the revisionist approach is that they're more bourgeois, right? They're upper middle class. There's a lot of optimism around building agriculture, whatnot, but it's not the primary focus like it is for labor Zionism. They're more cosmopolitan in some senses. So there are differences between revisionist Zionists and labor Zionists, and you see those most clearly once the state actually is formed. And we're going to see that a lot as we go through this year, because in those first 30 years of the establishment of the state, it's labor Zionism, and the political leaders come from labor Zionism. And then Begin comes, and Begin is from Europe. He's comfortable putting on a kippah. The labor Zionists never put on a kippah, right? He's comfortable talking about the Holocaust. He's comfortable speaking Yiddish in a way that the labor Zionists wouldn't have wanted to speak Yiddish, because that's a diaspora language, and they would need to be speaking the Sabra mother tongue of Hebrew. So then also, of course, Begin has different perspectives about how to engage with the Arabs that were quite different from the labor Zionists, except it's Begin ultimately, and we'll get there, who makes peace with Egypt, right, interestingly.
That's right.
Even though it's revisionist Zionists, it wasn't the labor Zionists or those from it who first were able to do that. So we'll come to that. But those are the major forms of Zionism. So this is all familiar to everyone. It seems as if you retained that. Should we? That's good. That's good.
It's coming back.
That's good. Do you guys need a break? Do you want a little break? Totally up to you. Okay, so then we're going to keep going. So let's just talk a little bit about the waves of Aliyah, just to refresh your memory as well, because it helps to just contextualize who's coming to the country when. So we won't spend too much time on it, but I think it is useful to have some sense. So in that first wave of Aliyah, and Aliyah literally means la'alot, to ascend. So right when you're called to the Torah in Aliyah, you're walking up to the Bima, right? So that's all. So and we talked about this last year. So the way Israelis and Israeli historiography talks about immigration are these different waves of Aliyah, because of course if you're coming from diaspora, you can only move up by coming to Israel. And this is why when you talk about immigration out of Israel, Yirida, to go down, Laredit, right? So it has a connotation associated with it. Israelis.
What's Laredit?
Laredit means to go down. Your Reddit means literally to go down the steps, for example. So it's a good thing to go up and move to the country. It's a bad thing to go down and leave the country. So the first waves of Aliyah are really happening between 1882 to 1903. Where were these people living when they came? What kind of place did they come to? They were living in Eastern Europe. They were living in Russia. But what kind of places did they... It's not developed. But remember the Moshavim? Remember that word? Moshavim were basically towns like Zichron Yaakov, Rishon LeZion, Petach Tikva, these kinds of places. These were the places where the community from Eastern Europe, Russia, are coming to. These are people, remember the idea of Chivat Zion and Chovavei Zion, those little communities in Russia, in Eastern Europe, who had these Zionist inclinations, and they kind of moved together, almost like a youth group, right? They kind of moved together, and then they have the support of these outside philanthropists, because God knows they have no money.
So were these families, I don't remember, or were they like...
It's mostly individuals, mostly men, some families, but it's mostly younger people.
But these were not the people that were working the land.
Well, they don't know how to do agriculture, but they're trying to do agriculture.
Rothschild sent back that letter, he was so angry.
That's right. So they're trying to do it. They actually are trying to figure out how do we, you know, businessmen, right, or users, right, the people who were the money lending exchange, basically that middleman in Europe, in Eastern Europe with money, how do we actually work the land? How do we become farmers? They actually don't know how to do it, though, but that's sort of what they're trying to figure out. And they have this very romanticized idea of what settling the land of Israel is supposed to be. But they don't know what they're doing.
Were they purchasing the land at that time?
So the philanthropists are purchasing land, not these particular individuals. The philanthropists are purchasing the land so that they can create these collectivist communities like the Moshavim, the Kibbutzim. And they're purchasing the land from absentee landowners, or they're purchasing the land from the Ottoman Empire.
Mm.
Right? That's how they're actually getting the land. And the absentee landowners are literally not present. They're either in the West or they're in other parts of the Ottoman Empire. They're in Syria, what will become Syria, what will become Jordan. But they're not in this land of Palestine. And so those individuals have basically left the land. There may be, it doesn't mean that no one's on the land. It just means that they're willing to sell it to others. And this is also a time, it's 1882, 1903, money is, as always, a serious commodity, right? So people are willing to give up that land because ideology, and this is where Palestinian nationalism comes into play, is not a thing. It's not a thing. So people are okay with saying, if you want to give me X amount, here's the deed. Also, there are no good records of who really owns what. We talked about this, right? So Ken Stein is really the academician who's done the most work on land transfers, but it's clear that at this early stage, this is before the Jewish agency is set up, that
it's a free-for-all.
It's very much a free-for-all. And this is no different than other parts of empire. You know, empires
wild
are still... That's right. So this comparatively is no different from other places.
So they
in the
give
world.
Money, but there's no contract written up for anything.
Not really. In some cases, there actually is a deed, but not in all cases.
And the deed isn't registered.
That's right.
Necessarily that the person that originated the deed.
No, that's right. And it's not. That's exactly right.
They own the land.
That's right. So that's the first wave of Aliyah, and this is when you have. You know, the beginnings of Zionism. And this is when Herzl looks at the Moshavim, the Moshavot, and he says, this is really small scale. This is not going to cut it. Like, if we're going to make a go of this, this is not what it could be because we're not going to get anywhere. So this is when Herzl and people like Jabotinsky as well really begin to say, If this is going to happen as a movement, it can't happen in this fashion. So then you have the second wave of Aliyah. And the second wave of Aliyah is from 1904 to 1914. And during the second wave of Aliyah, this is very much when you start to see that socialist ideology come into play. And this is also when you start to see a split internally. Herzl is no longer alive. He dies in 1904. So you begin to really hear that cacophony within Zionism as a movement. And I said it a lot last year. Zionism, they're really, at this point, is not a monolithic Zionism. It's really Zionisms, right? Because there are a lot of different visions for what this place could look like. And this is also when you start to see males, young males, right, without families, coming to the country, trying to build it, make a go of it, to try to think about what the establishment of this place will be. Third Aliyah. The third Aliyah is from 1919 to 1923. And the third wave of Aliyah are Jews who are very socialist in nature. It's in many ways a continuation of the second Aliyah. Remember, this is taking place during the period of World War I, the Great War. So Palestine is under Ottoman control during this period. And this is also why you have very, in comparison, few Jews coming from Russia, because the Ottoman Empire and the Russians are a threat to the Ottoman Empire, if you recall your World War I history. So that part of the Jewish population is not coming into Palestine in a very serious way.
So it was more Germany?
In the 1920s, you have a lot of Germans coming in, but it's Eastern Europeans still, you know, for the most part. But you have Germans coming in too. And it's Germans who have that strong socialist background. These particular Germans do. It's the Yekka German type. Yekka, it's a type of German Jew. That's what they're referred to. Y-E-K-K-E.
I've never heard of that.
A Yekka is a German Jew.
Yeah.
Really?
Is that
Yiddish? Is that
probably.
A derogatory term? No, it's not a derogatory term. Like, people will talk about if you're on Jewish time and Yekka Jewish time, you're always on time, versus Jewish time from these Roxy countries where you're always late. A Yekka German Jew, if you say you have a meeting at 8 o'clock, is there at 7:55. Right? A Mizrahi Jew is going to be there at 8:05. Right? If you're lucky.
If you're lucky.
That's right. So, that's all it is. The fourth wave of Aliyah. The fourth wave of Aliyah is 1924 to 1929. Remember, 1929, this is when you have the crash of the market, the Great Depression. So by the 1930s, you have well over one-third of Jews who are on social relief, right, who really need to be taken care of and are receiving support from others.
What,
so one-third.
In so, Palestine.
Yeah, but beyond Palestine as well. Because
Jews all over the world,
because right? This is the Great Depression. I mean, this is impacting everything.
The majority from America?
By the 1930s, one-third of Jews writ large are on relief. And by the 1930s, you still have the major place of Jewish populations are Europe at this point. I mean, they're not yet in America, and they're not yet in Palestine. So they're receiving support from others. This wave of Aliyah, this fourth wave of Aliyah, are mostly Polish. They're mostly middle class. This is the wave of Aliyah where Menachem Begin is coming from. And these are the Jews who also are trying to get out of Europe. If they really see the writing on the wall about what is to come. Whereas the fifth Aliyah is between 1929 and 1939. And so this is when, you know, Hitler is in power by 1933. So this is really the wave of German immigration, Daryl, because these are the Jews of Germany who are trying to get out.
What was the fifth?
What are
the years? 1929. To 1939.
What separates? I mean, how arbitrarily says this is the third wave, fourth wave?
Yeah, so it's not so arbitrary, actually, because what you can see is where people are coming from on the map and the motivations for why they are coming. Right? So, for example, in the fifth Aliyah, you're mostly seeing Germans coming to Israel, I mean, Palestine, German Jews, and you're mostly seeing those who are coming specifically and explicitly because of a refugee need, right?
Well,
that's what's happening.
Would an example be like in the fifth Aliyah, it would be more families, whereas in the third Aliyah, where it's the socialist in nature, it's the young men.
That's
coming.
Right. It's young individuals. Like, it's also women, but they're young, right? They're not connected yet. They haven't built families. They're coming for purely idealistic reasons. Whereas
by the time the fifth Aliyah, they're coming with their kids and their parents.
Oh, yeah. And most of them aren't Zionists.
Right.
The fifth Aliyah,
there's
no ideology necessarily for some of them. They got to get the hell out of Germany, right? They got to get out. And so they just need to get out and to find a place that will take them.
So are these people that are paying that have money to enter?
Yes. Yes. And their choice may not be Palestine as the first choice. But they know they need to get out of Europe, right? So either they wanted to go to America and they didn't get in, or they say, well, we already have some family. Our cousin is already over there, so we're going to go to Palestine. For some, it becomes a stopping ground before they come to America, actually. So each wave of Aliyah, just to get back to that original question, really is people taking a look at where they're coming from and what's motivating them to come. And that's how it's broken down. So it's similar to what you see in America too, right? We have waves of immigration here, and we can figure out why we had those waves and what's motivating those waves of immigration.
So when did the U.S. close its doors? When was that?
1930 something.
Did they actually close the door, or did
they
just
drastically
reduce?
They drastically limit.
Because I know that the Jews were considered Germans for immigration purposes.
Correct.
And so that's why.
Right.
You know, by closing it to Germans, they were all.
But they were drastically limiting the number of Jews that could come into the country.
So was Palestine.
Right, but Palestine Palestine was because of British control.
Right.
Remember, the people who controlled Palestine at this time, this is under the mandatory government of Britain. So it's the Majesty. Right, who's making these decisions from afar, and so Jews didn't have say in necessarily getting other Jews there. What was happening, and we talked a little bit about this when we looked at the impact of the Shoah, the Holocaust, on Israeli society, was that, remember we talked about how there were Zionists trying to figure out how they could bring certain groups from Europe, certain Jewish groups from Europe, and bring them over to Palestine and try to find ways and even perhaps broker relationships and deals that weren't so savory in order to save those Jews with members of the Polish government and others. So that was happening behind the scenes, and that wasn't with the help of the British, right? The British. And this is also, again, why Jabotinsky and the revisionists wanted the British gone. It's during this period that you have the emergence of the Irgun, that you have the emergence of the Stern Gang, right, the more strident right-wing group, because they're frustrated that Britain controls this country and that Britain isn't doing all it could be doing in order to save the Jews. From what's happening in Europe. And also remember, people didn't really know what was happening. I mean, we have hindsight. And there were some who were able to see the writing on the wall or understood enough that they needed to get out without having all of the details. But many, you have to remember, this was a very assimilated population of Jews living in Germany. And they didn't imagine when Hitler was coming to power that it was at all going to be what it became.
The Nazis actually encouraged immigration from Germany for a while. They wanted the Jews to leave.
Right.
At first.
Right. Right.
So there was the...
That's right. That's right. And at that point in time, though, it was such a small window in which that was the policy that most German Jews said, why would I leave? You know, they felt they were German. They were very integrated into society. They were part of the upper echelons of society. These weren't the lower socioeconomic classes within German society either. So that's
they were urban.
Oh yeah, very much so.
And
very much so.
In the news the other day, there was something about Netanyahu saying it wasn't.
Yes, you're correct.
Hitler. But was that, what side do you have of all that? Because that was a whole controversial thing in the news. And
I mean, in reading, I mean,
there was another article that was going around basically saying that Netanyahu is historically accurate, that this, you know, it's, you know,
so,
Germany came right out and said, no, we were responsible for it. I mean, it was
right, the first time Germany really wanted to own it. Okay, so what happened, for those of you who may have missed this? Netanyahu really wanted to make the claim that the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was, just so you know, appointed by the British and put into power, was really the architect, we could say, of the extermination of the Jews, the ideas behind it, and that it was through the collaboration with Hitler that Hitler was able to actualize what was really the Mufti's idea. Now, here's what I can tell you as a historian. As a historian, I can tell you that Benjamin Netanyahu knows history. So why did he say what he did? I think he did it on purpose for political spin. Because Netanyahu knows, whose father was one of the most preeminent historians ever, he knows history. And he knows very clearly that it was not the ideas of the Mufti. It is very true that the Mufti and Hitler collaborated, and it's very true that they had both the influence of the Mufti and Hitler saw an enemy that they could unite on, which was the Jews, but it was not the Mufti's ultimate plan. It was Hitler's. So why did he do it? I think he did it, one, because it made those who know history have to say what the relationship was between the Mufti and the Germans, and that's really not a piece of history that many people know, especially people who are not invested in this conversation. So the fact that there had to be a discussion around collaboration between Arabs and Nazis, that's exactly what Netanyahu wanted people to talk about. Secondly, the Mufti is one of the most, he's one of the personalities within this period of history that is one of the personalities that brings out incitement against the Jews, incitement toward the Jews, in a very theologically based way, as well as a political way. So he really fuses, one of the first, the theological with the political in terms of hatred towards the Jews. The Mufti does this. And he's a very polarizing figure, and he's a figure that is very important within Palestinian nationalism to this day. And so, as being because he is an important figure, he's similar to how some people would talk about Ben Gurion for Israel, right? Like that's how Palestinians talk about him. So it makes a direct connection between this incitement towards the Jews and this connection between theological and political dislike towards the Jews.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So I've read a bit about this week. So obviously in the American press, it's not playing well.
Sure.
And for the people that I know that are really pro-Israel on all levels, it's actually playing pretty well. They're drawing certain conclusions, you know, that historically he does know his history. How is it playing in the Palestinian communities in that it seems to me Netanyahu is further inciting them because he's basically, you know, that this would be a person that's popular among them, and by saying this, they're saying, yes, he says to exterminate the Jews, and that's what we're doing.
It doesn't, so I would make the argument it doesn't incite the Palestinians
okay,
any more than it already does.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The Palestinians are already at the point of where they are.
Okay.
This is not going to change that.
Okay. That was,
at
they
all.
Don't, they don't care.
They could care less.
Okay. That was my question.
That's my own.
Maybe they're proud of it.
They are very proud of it.
Yeah,
and again, we have to be, I want to be careful. It's not Palestinians writ large are not looking to kill all Jews, right? That we know that, so I don't want to generalize. But those who are more willing to
This isn't going to further incite that.
No.
People. Okay, that's what I was curious about.
It's not. They've already, they're at a point of no return, right? So it confirms for them. It doesn't exacerbate.
Okay.
It confirms, and they say, that's right. That's who he was. We're in that same position.
Okay.
Those Palestinians who, many of them, who want nothing to do with this, want nothing to do with the history of the Mufti either, right? It didn't help them in any shape or form. But what's problematic is that just as all nation states or hopeful nation states and all nations have narratives and myths, and the Mufti holds a very prominent position within the Palestinian national myth. And so whether you like Netanyahu or not, he wanted to draw attention to that.
Okay.
And I think that's what he was doing, because I don't doubt for a second that Netanyahu doesn't know his history.
Well, it should be clear that it's totally false.
Right. I mean, people are doing that.
It's disgraceful for him to say.
Right. So people are doing that. So there have been a lot of pieces out drawing that conclusion and saying. There's a person named Jeffrey Herf, H-E-R-F. He wrote a piece in the Times of Israel this past week that if you haven't read, you should definitely look at, because it talks, Peggy, specifically about this. And Jeffrey is a specialist on Nazi propaganda. He's an academic from University of Maryland. But he knows the details as well, historically, about the relationship between the Mufti and Hitler. And so he writes, basically, for the first 10 paragraphs, let me tell you why Netanyahu was completely wrong, and here's the historical facts. But let me also tell you about the Mufti and why, yes, what he said is inaccurate, but why the Mufti and the relationship the Mufti had and who the Mufti was is extremely problematic. So it's worth a read.
It's really interesting because, you know, I mean, you see the propaganda. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I've got some friends who are seriously anti-Israel, and they're going to send, you know, on their list, and I get their articles, and they make my boil as much as the other stuff does.
Sure.
But it's that's what I was trying
that's
to
right.
figure
it's
out.
It's the stuff my father says I'm not supposed to read after 10 p.m., right? So, that's right. So, yes. Okay, so in the last few minutes here, I want to just mention, after the fifth wave of Aliyah, you actually stop hearing the term Aliyah, but there's still waves of immigration. So the next major wave of immigration is with the Sephardim and the Mizrahi, right? Jews coming from the Spanish countries, Spain, Iberia, Portugal, and throughout the Middle East and North Africa, Libya, Iraq, Morocco, Iran, Persia, Egypt. And these are mostly Jews coming after the state has been created, mostly in the 1950s, and they're coming because now is when they are facing greater persecution. Once the state is established, you have pogroms in Baghdad.
It's like my father's heritage.
That's right. That's right. And this is actually called Eidot HaMizrah, which is like the group of the Mizrahim, the group from the east. So this happens in the 1950s. You then have a lot of Romanians who come. And then the next really major population that starts to move to Israel are the Russians. So you start to see that in the 60s, but then very much so in the 70s and absolutely in the 80s. For all the reasons that you know, right? These are the Jews who have been living in the Soviet Union, who have been oppressed from the time of Stalin, who many of them don't really even know that they're Jewish or have a very superficial understanding of what that means to be Jewish. And then partly because of the Jackson-Vanik Agreement, right? All of this is when you start to see Soviet Jewry movement. This is Sharansky, right? This is also under Reagan and Gorbachev and Perestroika. So that's when this is taking place.
The 60s through the 80s?
Yeah, I mean, it's very small in the 60s. It grows exponentially in the 70s and 80s in terms of Soviet Jews who are coming to Israel.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Are there was there a specific time period where Americans...
So great question. That's exactly where we're going. So that is who we have just come to, right? We don't hear about American Jews in large numbers making Aliyah. American Jewry, by far, is of diaspora Jewries, is the least Zionistic ideologically. The American Jews are in support much more so in terms of philanthropy, right? They provide philanthropy, maybe some visit more regularly than others, but American Jews overall are not making Aliyah. So when you go to the Shabbat table of your friends and your cousin, or you're at the Pesach Seder of your sister-in-law's, if you hear that their daughter or son is going to Princeton, and then their brother is making Aliyah, you say, ah, he clearly couldn't have made it in America, right? Or he's failing in some way, right? That's how it's been in American Jewry, right? It has a very different perception than...
Well, I also think there's like a lot of, or maybe there wasn't, but in my mind, there's a lot of talk about it, but very little action.
Yeah, so I think, it depends when we're talking about in American history, obviously, but first of all, America is a unique society. I would argue that America is actually not the norm, right, in terms of nation states throughout the world. America is very much this immigrant nation state. It's not an ethno-nationalist state like other places. Mm-hmm. So one, it makes it different in terms of immigrants in general. And the goal here is to be able to succeed and assimilate and integrate, and you have this melting pot, right? That's the idea of the melting pot, and everyone comes with their backgrounds, but they melt and become American. So that's part of why you don't have Zionism in the way that you have that ideology play out in other diasporas. The other piece of this is that we don't have that push factor, right? In these other places, you had a serious push factor of anti-Semitism. America doesn't have that history at all in the same way. That's not to say that there have not been serious moments in American history of anti-Semitism. There have been, but not at all in comparison to the rest of diaspora communities. So that's another piece of this. So the American role in Zionism is quite different. Unless you're coming from a very ultra-Orthodox Haredi community in America, Aliyah in general is not on the table for American Jews. Visits to Israel, yes, all the more so now with Birthright. And in certain modern Orthodox communities, it is possible for sure and much more feasible. But when you move beyond the modern Orthodox, it is not going to happen for most conservative and Reform Jews. Especially.
When Israel was first established, you know, probably because of, you know, what religious Zionism said and the whole Messianic movement, the ultra-Orthodox were not in favor of this.
Correct.
When did this flip? When did they become sort of this linchpin that's going into the settlements and...
Right. So remember, first of all, too, we have to be careful when we say ultra-Orthodox, because that can mean some of the people like Neturei Karta who are anti-Zionist.
Okay.
Right? So within ultra-Orthodoxy, there are subsects,
okay.
Right? Now, the Neturei Karta type, it's a very small minority that's anti-Zionist, but they're the ones you see who are out there and with holding hands with Ahmadinejad, for example, and it's crazy. Now, the ultra-Orthodox in general, and we're going to get more to this later, so I'm going to just say it very briefly and not give you a full answer, but you really start to see the change in terms of those, and I don't want to say ultra-Orthodox, but those who recognize that the importance of Israel has this theological religious component, and after 1967, when the territories become part of Israel, not annexed, but are under Israeli authority, that motivation, for many, propels them to be engaged in Israel in a way that they hadn't been previously. The other piece of this is that in the 1950s, 1948, 1950s, no one imagined, especially Ben-Gurion, that the religious community was going to grow. Everyone imagined that after the destruction of the Holocaust, that that community was ultimately going to dissipate completely. And not because necessarily for any negative reasons, but Ben-Gurion truly believed, and others believed, that religion was going to fall by the wayside, and it was going to be a non-primal identity for people. That was wrong. Right? The assumption was ultimately wrong.
Wasn't that why he agreed to give religious...
Absolutely. He made some of the... That's right. So that's why I'm not going to go into all of it, and we're going to go there, but that's absolutely why accommodations were made with the religious community, because he thought ultimately they weren't going to be there. But that was completely not accurate. Right? So that's also a change that many didn't foresee. Okay. Now we're going to talk about Jews and Arabs. It will sort of be interlaced throughout this entire year. There are some pieces that will be focused on particularly, like the War of Independence in 1948. We'll talk about all the other names it has as well. We'll talk about that with the 1967 war. Those are really primarily the most important wars that we're going to really talk about, not even just in terms of military history, but in terms of geopolitical, in terms of how it impacts the society, and in terms of the history. We're not going to do a lot of military-type history, but we will talk about relations with the Arabs. It will be part of this continual conversation. And we will be talking about throughout these content areas that relate to themes like the role of Judaism in Israel and Jewishness and how this plays out, looking at the idea of state building and what that will look like and how one goes about creating a state when you have this type of society with all these different waves of Aliyah and who these people are, what's going to unite them. So this is where we're headed. So I think... Are you guys up for 10 minutes of a clip of a film?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's how we're going to end. It's not the best pedagogically to end on this note, but it's worth, I think, just showing this to you very briefly if it works. Just a few minutes of this film. So I'm going to... So this is called The Zionist Idea, but it's actually being renamed. So I think they want to rename it to something like Dreams Collide or Colliding Dreams. It's actually not that great of a name, but we'll see what happens.
It's coming out in this new Jewish Film Festival.
It should be upcoming. Yeah, whenever the new Jewish Film Festival is, sometime in the spring usually.
Oh,
maybe it's the winter. I have no idea.
The Jewish Film Festival starts next week.
It's coming next week or the week after.
So maybe then. Whatever you know more than I do. I clearly don't go to film, so I don't get out. Yeah. Okay, so let me show you. So I'm going to just show you.
Can you
see this?
Native.
Can you see?
You can feel native. Why? Because you now identify.
Hold on, I'm going to scoot back just a little bit.
Call a place. Actually.
Okay.
They adopted the language. Some of them adopted a new name.
The
children taught the mother the mother tongue. One priority of nationalism was always to revive all traditions of Hebrew was resource. And then you plug yourself into life before rabbinical Judaism took over and left the biblical Judaism. And the Zionists started reading the Bible as such. Through the pages of the Bible, they rediscovered a national history long before the diaspora and dreamed of creating a modern version of the ancient Jewish nation.
Whenever the pioneers would go exploring the country, they would take the Bible with them. They followed King Saul on the mountains of Gilboa. They followed King David in the Valley of Elah, where he killed Goliath. this was not a religious attachment to the Bible. They saw themselves as part of these dramas, and for them the Bible became the book that made them citizens of the country from time immemorial.
That's Anita Shapiro.
Ah!
That's awesome.
This was the main, if you want, religion, belief system of the Zionist movement.
Who's
that? That they're creating a new land, a new people, and to educate young people about fictives are springing from the earth of the homeland. My father was a great high priest in that cult. My father went every Shabbat on his hikes. By that, our family acquired that attachment to the land. It is done in order to make you feel native, as if you can feel native. Why? Because you now identify an eagle or call a place by its Jewish name. You own it. I also have memories of the paradox, because the land was at that time occupied by Arabs, and we met Arabs. So, in my mind, the old Arab civilization that my father wanted to erase became part of me.
He's a geographer, and his father was also a government official.
In the early years of Zionism, certain groups sent a mission to Palestine to see whether it is really a place which millions of Jews can go into. So they went around Palestine, and then they came back and wrote a report. And the report would say something of the sort. Well, I think it was true. Palestine is a wonderful place. It's like a beautiful girl, but the girl is already engaged. Belongs already to some other people. But the pressure of Jewish need to have a place of their own, to have a secure place, to do away once and for all from anti-Semitism, especially in Eastern Europe, was so strong that nobody could stop it, and really nobody stopped it.
So that comment was actually in a letter that was written to Herzl.
The early settlers here were not only very aware of Palestinians. I mean, they couldn't not be. This town was surrounded within a 10-kilometer radius.
There were
11 or 12 Arab villages all around.
My grandfather's farm needed workers. There were no tractors, there were no machinery. Everything has to be done by hand. Traditionally, all the workers were Arabs, were Palestinians. We were little kids, 10, 12, and we were working here with the Arab workers. These were not people that came in the morning and left in the afternoon. There were people that came for 2-3 months.
They were staying with the whole families in the yards of the farmers. And
not just the workers.
Yeah, not just the workers. And for example, our father was breastfed from the lady that was in the yard.
An Arab lady. Our father workers.
So it's an Arab tradition that if my father drank the milk of the mother, we are the same family.
See, this is a wood plow. When they came here, they had no idea how to plow. And they learned this from the Arabs. This is actually a plow made by an Arab. They either borrowed or bought. The Arab farmer showed them how to use it, because they had no idea how to use plows like this.
They lived with the Arabs in many ways on the Arabs' terms. I mean, they ate the Arabs' foods, they went to the Arabs' weddings, they attended the Arabs' celebrations. There wasn't a Jew who didn't speak Arabic. Children grew up playing with Arabs in the yards. And there were Jewish gardens which dressed like Arabs. There was a kind of romance about Arabs. The two worlds were very closely integrated.
So I just want to show you that little bit.
Yeah, we have to move it.
The
we'll watch.
It's worth seeing.
Is that on YouTube?
No, so this is, I just happen to have the Vimeo piece from the director. But I think he, it'll be out soon.
The film festival will be November 11th through 15th.
I think the sisterhood, I feel like
sisterhood is going to something on the
11th.
It's sold out?
Yeah. I mean, I believe, so we can find out when it's playing. But I just wanted you to hear just even that little bit because, I mean, in some ways, what we're talking about is actually a much more complex time than what it was. And the facts on the ground have actually created some of that complexity that wasn't necessarily anticipated or expected, but has created a situation that is... What's said here is not at all possible any longer. And it's not only because of facts on the ground, but it's also in terms of how nationalism works and once you have a nation state, what that means and all of those pieces. But I thought it would be worth just putting that as part of this because it's very much going to be part of the conversation as we move throughout this year. So next week we meet. Next week, the topic we won't be reviewing, the topic is the topic you see for November 2nd, the struggle for statehood. It's a big chunk of Shapira and then some individual readings which are on the Dropbox. And we'll go from there. And if you have questions or you can't get on, let me know and we'll try to figure it out. But
so
I look, and this is where we'll be. We're going to be here.
In the
room.
Yes.
We all
in the basement with
that
clanging.
The first classroom we were in.
Oh, yeah. That's right. So thank you all.